Engagement with the Dharmapada, an invitation and introduction by James Lowe. With his approval, I've written the following few sentences, ending with a request. All the rest is from his book, Finding Freedom. This audio recording is formed from the introductions to the Dharmapada, written by James Lowe in his book Finding Freedom. Together with the commentary, they form the majority of the first section of the book. The other two sections are of Mahayana and Dzogchen teachings. In the book, James gives an explanation of these views, their methods, and the result of engagement with these different aspects of Buddhist teachings, and how they can facilitate our journey to the realization of freedom. Each section is based around a text or texts which are like precious gems. The brilliance of each gemstone will be revealed in the light of our engagement with it. Its potential to shine for us has been enhanced by the way in which it has been cut and polished, and also by its setting. In this first section, the Dharmapada is the gem. The commentary, the cutting and polishing, and the introduction, which forms the setting, help us to appreciate its value. The audio recording of the translation of the Dharmapada and commentary from the book is already in circulation. So if you have shared the link to the Dharmapada and commentary, please would you also share the link to this recording so that the text and its setting are brought together. The following passage is an extract from the general introduction in the book. The root of suffering is alienation from our source, and this suffering is maintained by non-attention to how our mind actually is. The fact of this non-attention is obscured by our ongoing activity of imagining how we are in ways that conceal rather than reveal what is simply present. When we do not awaken to our own mind as it is, but rely on beliefs that we have inherited from our families and cultures, we continue in the delusions these beliefs generate. If we can catch a glimpse of how erroneous our common beliefs are, then two paths open up. The first indicates there is a lot to be done, and therefore we should strive. The second indicates that we suffer due to succumbing to the illusion of lacking the direct non-dual presence of our own awareness, and therefore we should relax. When we seem to only have concepts to rely on in order to work out how we are, we can either avoid the issue altogether, which leaves us in delusion, or we can seek information. However, the accumulation of such information, presented as knowledge, offers us only concepts about our idea of our mind. This indirect, mediated relationship generates cover-up rather than revelation. In daily life, the mind itself seems invisible and somewhat irrelevant, and so is easily taken for granted. We have a mind. Of course we do. That is that. For most of us, most of the time, our concern is more with our personality and our experience of ourselves as we change and develop with the world around us. What is happening for me, to me, as me, seems to be who I am. And since these happenings are ever-changing, there is always something new to identify with, reflect on, or respond to. From the Buddhist point of view, this way of experiencing life is unlikely to generate much happiness, since it is inseparable from our sense that our personal identity is not as stable as we would like it to be. Insecurity, anxiety, and uncertainty feed both our sense of alienation and our longing for a reliable sense of belonging. The Buddha's teaching points the way to a different sense of oneself, one that is less dependent on happenstance and reactivity. the Buddha's illuminating insight is liberating if it is lived. It provides a path to liberation if understood and aligned with. But someone hearing his teaching for the first time may find it radical and shocking. We all have good days and bad, yet if we are lucky, then life seems basically okay. However, the Buddha indicates that we feel this because, at the moment, we have a comfortable cell in the prison of samsara. Causal factors lead us to be born in different realms, with different kinds of bodies, and different abilities and qualities. As specific causal factors are exhausted, new ones arise through which we find ourselves in a new form, with no recollection of what went before. When we see our existence in terms of transience and limitation, then the ideas of liberation, freedom, and enlightenment become much more meaningful. Buddhism is not an add-on to the life we have, but offers an awakening to a new vision of our potential. This book has three sections, each addressing the question of what our mind is and how it functions. The Buddha taught many different views or reorientations to help us loosen up from our habitual fixations. He was very aware of the rich diversity of beliefs and temperaments that sentient beings manifest through variations in interest in and access to their environment, levels of volatility and impulsivity, degrees of finesse in embodied motility, and so on. To simply present one truth and hope that everyone would find it meaningful was not the Buddha's way. Uniting wisdom and compassion, he revealed many thousands of pathways towards calmness and clarity, relaxation and creativity, profundity and connectivity. A short book like this can only touch on some key themes. However, if we let them, they can act as a mirror, allowing us to see more clearly who and how we actually are, free of the disguising identities we habitually adopt. The first section, Fight the Good Fight, contains a key text belonging to the Theravadan tradition of Buddhism. Here, the mind as we ordinarily experience it is understood as a tendency to believe in the inherent existence or individual reality of ourselves and all other sentient beings. Holding on to the idea that I am someone and you are someone else, I have to work out if I like you, as I take you to be, or do not like you. Our mind, seemingly organized by and around our ego self, is concerned with winning and losing, with getting more of the pleasant and less of the unpleasant. This entails a Sisyphus-like effort, since all situations, as complex compounded events, are unstable and impermanent, and therefore have to be repaired and recreated again and again. Sometimes impulses arise in us which undermine all that we have established, and sometimes it is outer events which hurl us into unpredictable states of becoming. The text presented in this first section is the Dharmapada, which sets out clearly the importance of ethics as the necessary frame of reference if we wish our experience to be fulfilling. Negative actions lead to negative consequences, and positive actions lead to positive consequences. This may seem oversimplistic and even naive, but such a sense of the determinism inherent in the unfolding of cause and effect provides a perspective, a distance from enmeshment, that allows us to review our intentions in the light of both their short and long-term outcomes. Activity of body, voice, and mind generates its own outcomes and consequences. No other, no God or devil, is rewarding or punishing us. It is the logic of intention and enactment that drives the multiplicity of possible resultant experiences. Who am I in this situation? What am I up to? How do I think about you? Who do I take you to be? Who do you seem to take yourself to be? If we are able to pose such questions so that they let us see our habitual identifications in a new way, then more options become available. We gain a meta vision that offers some protection against the vexations, provocations, and seductions of the engulfing moment. The Buddha pointed out that suffering, limitation, disappointment, and so on arise from causes. And if these causes are no longer activated, then suffering will end. The two key causes of suffering are, firstly, ignoring the actuality, the how-it-isness of each situation, and secondly, imagining that our interpretation is the simple truth. Believing what we imagine, our assumptions seem self-valid, while our ego self's craving for something real to hang on to is pacified by being fed intense illusions. Our minds are busy. In order to slow them down, we need to cut back on our aroused involvement, since desire and aversion distort and obscure the actual situation. The main Theravadin methods for such slowing are meditation to develop undistracted focus, ethical restraint of impulses and increased attention to others as other, and engagement in analysis of our assumptions and beliefs so that we can see the deluding quality of our comforting complacency. As long as my mind seems to be simply its current content of thoughts, feelings, memories, sensations, and so on, there is little reflective space. Therefore, these three methods of slowing are mobilized together to illuminate the possibility of letting go, of disengaging, so that new options are revealed, along with a new sense of the one who may choose or not. This leads to calmness and clarity, and to a fresh, mindful ease that is no longer driven by unconsidered mental events. Now we come to the introduction to the Dharmapada. The Dhammapada, Sanskrit Dharmapada, is a collection in 423 verses of short teachings by Buddha Shakyamuni, who lived between 563 and 483 BCE. Maintained at first solely in oral tradition, it seems to have been written down in the 3rd century BCE. What seems to be the original version is in the Kudaka Nikaya, belonging to the Sutta Pitaka of the Pali Canon. Many different versions and recensions arose through time, including the Udanavarga compiled by Dharmatrata, which was translated into Tibet at the time of King Ralpashen, and can be found in the Kangyur collection of the Buddha's speech. Buddha Ghosha in the 4th or 5th centuries CE prepared an edition, the Dharmapada Athakatha, in which each verse is supported by a story of how it came to be said. An edited version in English of this very lengthy text is available online as a PDF, and people have permission to access and print copies for their own use. It's entitled The Dharmapada and Its Commentary, edited by Bhikshu Pesala, Association for Insight Meditation, January 2018. The translation offered here is based largely on the 20th century translation into Tibetan by Gendun Chirpal, a Gelugpa monk who spent many years in India. The translation was done in 1980 by C.R. Lama and James Lowe for inclusion in a volume containing Pali, Sanskrit, Tibetan and English versions. This is now freely available online at the website simplybeing.co.uk/Dharmapada/. See also vandalverlag.de/finding-freedom-dlds. The term Dharmapada indicates the footprint or impression of the Dharma, the truth about existence revealed by the Buddha. And this short text is an accessible presentation of the key points of Buddha Shakyamuni's teaching. Although grouped in chapters, it can be opened at any page, since each verse has its own specific point to make. The background is the teaching given by Buddha Shakyamuni on the Four Noble Truths: suffering, the cause of suffering, the ending of suffering, and the way to end suffering. These set the frame for all subsequent Buddhist practice. Suffering is a fact, the truth of which is a call to abandon complacency. We will all become old, sick, and then die. This is what happens. Even if our lives are easy, war and famine, flood and fire, unemployment, enforced refugee existence, and many, many problems are present in the world around us. This suffering has a cause which, due to the kindness of the Buddha, is now known. Ignorance or inattention to the actual truth of experience leads to the delusion that self and others have real, inherent existence. I am someone. I am me. This belief becomes an object of clinging and is often lived as an irreducible fact. The unstable, ungrounded ego has a thirst for the pleasure that arises through contact between our sense consciousnesses and the appearances of the world. On the basis of the seeming givenness of me as me, and you as the you I take you to be, liking and disliking arises, followed by actions of desireful involvement or aversive discarding. Due to this, we act to increase our benefit and to avoid pain. This intentional activity has a causal force which gives rise to karmic consequences manifesting long after the initial event. As a result of these propulsive tendencies, we find ourselves wandering in samsara, the endless cycle of birth and death, moving to the upper realms when good actions ripen, and to the lower realms and hells when bad actions ripen. This is our actual situation. We will soon die, yet we have a brief window of opportunity to, firstly, mobilize ethics, and so diminish bad action and increase good action. Secondly, to learn to calm the mind, diminishing involvement in whatever occurs. And thirdly, through this non-involvement, learn to see the confusion that arises from taking the transient content of our experience as a support for our deluded belief in our real existence. The third truth is that of the ending of suffering. This cessation is available to all sentient beings. Our mind, the center and basis of everything we do and are, is not to be found in its content, neither as the objects that appear to be outside, nor as the subject that seems to be the experiencer within. Subject and object are transient, but the mind is not. When this misleading fusion is disidentified from, the mind's own clarity is revealed as deathless liberation. Fourthly, there is a path to gain the cessation of suffering. This is the Noble Eightfold Path. Right knowledge or vision, seeing the fact of impermanence and the absence of inherent existence. Right intention, deciding to follow the path. Right speech, clear and undeceiving. Right action, behavior guided by the teachings. Right livelihood, supporting yourself with work that is ethical and helpful and not harmful. Right effort, focusing on developing virtue and diminishing evil and harm. Right mindfulness, undistracted attention to all details of what is occurring. Right meditation, concentrating on the practice so that the misleading refuge of thoughts, feelings, and sensations can be dispensed with. This Eightfold Path is not a set of options. All eight aspects need to be practiced. This is the basic reorientation offered by the Buddha. He offers two maps, a map of the prison and a map of the way out of the prison. We are trapped, though we hardly even know it. When we see that we are on the way to death and to the loss of all that we know, and moreover, that this process will be repeated again and again and again in life after life until we put a stop to it, we have the first breath of freedom. Avoiding the bad, developing the good, and cutting off craving so that the mind can taste true contentment form the heart of the practice. The mind is chief, not our feelings, not the shiny objects and people of this world. This is the basis of the turn towards renunciation, which helps to separate us from involvement in samsara. In a busy life with many demands, the outer renunciation of living in a forest is rarely feasible. Yet the renunciation of non-involvement is always possible in any situation. The text talks a lot about taints. This refers to the mark or stain that occurs when we leak out into the world with our aroused emotions, and when the world leaks into us so that we feel invaded and overwhelmed. To avoid this, we must be attentive, heedful, and careful. The intoxication of the moment is our greatest danger, for then we are carried away by aspects of self and environment that are privileged, causing everything else to be relegated to the background. It is as if this is all there is, and this is all I am. Blind passion catches us, and only later do we become conscious of even the immediate outcome of our actions, while we remain oblivious to the future karmic consequences. We have to choose between the intoxicating excitement of heedless involvement or the calm spaciousness of clarity. This clarity is neither cut off and avoidant nor self-abandoning into fusion. The middle way, avoiding the extremes, is the true path to freedom. To stay sure-footedly on this path requires us to develop life-affirming qualities, such as diligence, patience, commitment, and courage. The Buddhist view very clearly sets out that life has a purpose. We are not mere puppets of fate thrown about in the pinball machine of happenstance. We sentient beings, each and every one of us, no matter how limited our current situation, can gain unchanging freedom through liberation from all that limits us. The Mahamangala Sutra says, "To live in the world, with your heart undisturbed by the world, with all sorrows ended, dwelling in peace, this is the greatest happiness." The Anguttara Nikaya says, "Loss and gain, disrepute and fame, praise and blame, pleasure and pain, these things are transient in human life, inconstant and bound to change. The mindful, wise one discerns them well, observant of their alterations. Pleasant things do not excite his mind, nor do the unpleasant annoy him. All likes and dislikes are dispelled by him, eliminated and abolished. Aware now of the stainless, griefless state, he fully knows, having gone beyond." Seeing the suffering around us, it is important to bring the relief of Dharma to others according to our capacity. In fact, being aware of the needs of others can spur us on to deepen our study and practice. The Vinaya Pitaka says, "Therefore, go forth, brethren, on your journey, for the joy of the many, for the happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world. teach the Dharma which is beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful at the end. Freedom from suffering is the goal, and all the methods and encouragements in this text have that as their focus. But we must choose, and if we choose freedom, we have to struggle with our own habits of adopting small identities. Letting go of attachment means that we go from the definite knowledge of who we think we are to an experience of openness, indefinability, and potential. When we give up clinging, our view widens and we can start to see the world as it is and allow the impact of others' suffering to awaken our love and compassion. Many verses in this text praise the solitary life, a life which is not resting on cultural assumptions about what is important. In Western societies, virgin marriage was important in the past, but no longer. Now it is tattoos that give one a stylish identity. All such signs are transient. To find what is stable and enduring, we have to let go of fads and the wish to be approved of by those around us. Of course, Buddhism as a social formation, manifesting under specific cultural conditions, carries with it, along with the unchanging value of Dharma, certain cultural attitudes which are less and less valid in the modern world. The text is strongly focused on men as the sole beings who can study and practice Dharma. There is a lot about being a good monk and avoiding ordinary life or a worldly existence. But deep Dharma is for all, since all beings have a mind, the one necessity for awakening. The mind is necessary, but not sufficient, since effort is required to engage in study and practice. Now, in the West, such study and practice is freely available for all, so we should be like the great goose in Indian mythology, which can drink the milk and leave the water it was mixed with. Go for the nectar and leave the dross. Freedom is clean, fresh, bright, alive, and it rests on nothing. In order to let go of what we know and value, we rely on the teachings as a transitional support. We have to trust them more than our own moods, memories, impulses, and desires. As the text says, fools trust themselves and so sign up for suffering. Getting lost is easy. Our habits and tendencies will effortlessly lead us astray. And of course, if the goal of liberation is not guiding us, then we will not even notice that we have gone astray. To stay on the path, we must become immune to the enticements of the passing show. Liberation is the goal. Study gives us a map. Meditation practice gives us a method. But we have to do the work. We have the necessary foundation, our own mind. So, now we have to choose freedom or captivity. As the Buddha said at the end of his life, all compounded things are subject to vanishing. Strive with earnestness. This, together with the introduction to the Dharmapada recordings which follows, was written by James Lowe and read and recorded by Wendy, October 2021. The Dharmapada is a book of excellent advice on how to manage the many trials and tribulations of life. Taught by the Buddha, this is an ethical guide to disciplined and compassionate existence. The consequences of blind self-indulgence are revealed in wars, pandemics, and the impending catastrophe of climate change. The word discipline is not very popular in current culture and seems to imply an unwelcome imposition. However, for most of us, when we stop and review our life, we find that our ego self is frequently wild and untamed. When this is replicated in the billions of inhabitants of the earth, it is not surprising that chaos is pervasive. However, here we have a chance to listen to the deep and soothing words of the Buddha, offering support and guidance for those who wish to live in harmony with others and with the world we inhabit. May it bring peace to all. Following the introductions and before the text, there is the following refuge prayer. I take refuge in the Buddha, the best of all humans. I take refuge in the Dharma, peaceful and free of desire. I take refuge in the renunciate Sangha, who have the best assemblage.